focused on Mary's acting in history. But with a personal dimension to it for each of us. I'm director of Lutheran Social Services in Tacoma, Washington, and come with a background of social activism, various types, and over the years, civil rights movement, the peace movement, dealing with housing, social education related to interracial activities and so forth. And I bring my experience to this text study. This is a little different, I suppose, than you're used to. Maybe not, but my sense it probably is. It's a little different for me. What I would like to do this next 2 weeks is to use scripture as a discernment process for what it says in itself, in history, as well as our own story and what our lives say in history. This comes from the Division of Congregational Life. This process comes from Division of Congregational Life for the ELCA. And it's built upon the last 8 or 9 years, starting at the ALC and LCA, of trying to develop ways in which social ministry can develop and be expressed through congregations. And I've been exposed to this just recently, personally in a very intense way in February, where the ELCA called together representatives from congregations across the country. Maybe some of you have been part of this process in your own home areas. One component of the ELCA process is biblical reflection on story for application and expression in our own lives. About 2 months ago, Nancy Vignette, who works with me, says we need somebody for text study for these 2 weeks, and I had planned to come up here for a week anyway, so I said, I'll be glad to do it. I was feeling love Holden Village, and this area really appeals to me, so she said, sure. So here I am, and want to share with you this perspective, this way of doing things. And I think I got a good omen for this at my own congregation in Olympia just a week ago Sunday. The theme there was, the ninth Sunday of Pentecost was unity through diversity. And that's part of this whole ELCA process, is recognizing the fact that we have a diverse society, many different experiences, many different cultures, many different racial groups and so forth. And it tries to bring together the diverse components. And in Chicago, when I was there in February, we had a strong expression of Native American story, Black American, African-American stories, the South African, gay and lesbian expressions and experiences, as well as lay and pastors giving their own expressions to what life in social ministry means to them. So last Sunday, when I was at church, this was a theme expressed, and it kind of came to a crescendo when the pastor was preparing for the Eucharist and said, here is a loaf of bread from Holden Village, and full of grains that are very nourishing. And my daughter standing next to me looked at me and smiled and said, you know, hey, we're going there. for me, Holden has been a source of nourishment, not just physical nourishment, but more spiritual nourishment. So I connect personally my experiences here with my home life and my professional life. I really feel that the yeast, you know, from Holden, and I'm hoping that some of that comes across to you through this experience here. The Eucharist is very meaningful to me. I love the Eucharist, and I see the Eucharist as a way to give thanks and a way to present my struggles and my experiences in context of community and with God as expressed in community. And I get through the Eucharist, I bring my life for more wholeness, and I get strength to go out and continue to fight the battles of human needs as Lutheran Social Services experiences, as well as my own private expression of that private. Private's not the right word. I don't think it's private, but outside of the job type expression. So today might be a little different for you in that we're not going to analyze text too much. So some people have great expertise, and I welcome some insights, but I'm hoping that we can look at these passages as people who are trying to discover the ways God is calling them and enabling them to act in history, to make an impact on history, and then to connect that to our own personal callings and our own acting in history. So maybe for a moment we can just close our eyes and reflect on the fact that God is with us and acting within us as well as among us. And the presence of God is always active, always vital, and we are responding by trying to discern God's presence, God's actions, and respond as we are called to, as we choose to, and therefore become more vital persons. And so getting ready to reflect on this, recall that we too are actors in history, that we too are called to express the love and truth and justice efforts that Christ and other biblical persons have shown us. The first passage that I'd like to deal with is Exodus chapters 3 and 4, and I was wondering if somebody would mind reading. Maybe somebody could read chapter 3 and then somebody else could read chapter 4. It's the story of Moses and his experience being called out of, he was exiled, fled Egypt, and he's out tending flocks, and it's a narration of his experience of being called by God to go lead the people of Israel out of their bondage. So if you could look at his experience, and then we can discuss it after it's read. So is anybody able to read?
Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and lo, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight. Why, the bush is not burnt. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here am I." Then God said, "Do not come near. Put off your shoes from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." And he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, "I have seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring forth my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt?" God said, "But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought forth the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God upon this mountain." Then Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'I am sent me to you.'" God also said to Moses, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you and what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will hearken to your voice. And you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. And now we pray you, let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with all the wonders which I will do in it. After that, he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty. But each woman shall ask of her neighbor and of her who sojourns with her in her house, jewelry of silver and of gold and clothing. And you shall put them on your sons and on your daughters. Thus you shall despoil the Egyptians."
Then Moses answered the Lord, "But suppose the Israelites do not believe me and will not listen to what I say. What shall I do if they say you did not appear to me?" So the Lord asked him, "What are you holding?" "A walking stick," he answered. The Lord said, "Throw it down on the ground." Moses threw it down, and it turned into a snake, and he ran away from it. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Reach down, pick it up by the tail." So Moses reached down, caught it, and it became a walking stick again. The Lord said, "Do this and prove to the Israelites that the Lord, the God of their ancestors, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to you." The Lord spoke to Moses again, "Put your hand inside your robe." Moses obeyed, and when he took his hand out, It was diseased and covered with white spots like snow. The Lord said, put your hand inside your robe again. He did so. And when he took it out this time, it was healthy, just like the rest of his body. And the Lord said, if they will not believe you, or will not be convinced by the first miracle, then this one will convince them. If in spite of these two miracles, they still will not believe you, and if they refuse to listen to what you say, take some water from the Nile and pour it into the ground. The water will turn into blood. But Moses said, no, Lord, don't send me. I've never been a good speaker. I haven't become one since you began to speak to me. I'm a poor speaker, slow and hesitant. The Lord said to him, who gives man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or dumb? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? It is I, the Lord. Now go. I will help you to speak, and I will tell you what to say. But Moses answered, no, Lord, please send somebody else. At this, the Lord became angry with Moses, and he said, but what about your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. In fact, he is coming to meet you and will be glad to see you. If you can speak to him and tell him what to say, I will help both of you to speak, and I will tell you what to do. He will be your spokesman, and speak to the people for him. Then you will be like God, telling him what to say. Take this walking stick with you, and with it you will perform the miracle. Then Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, please let me go back to my relatives in Egypt to see if they are still alive. And Jethro agreed and told him goodbye. While Moses was still in Midian, the Lord said to him, go back to Egypt, for all those who wanted to kill you are dead. So Moses took his wife and his sons and put them on a donkey and set out with them for Egypt, carrying the walking stick that the Lord had told him to take. Again, the Lord said to Moses, now that you're going back to Egypt, be sure to perform before the king all the miracles which I have given you the power to do. But I will make the king stubborn, and he will not let the people go. Then you must tell him that I, the Lord, say, Israel is my firstborn son. I told you to let my son go so that he might worship me, but you refused. Now I'm going to kill your firstborn son. At a camping place on the way to Egypt, the Lord met Moses and tried to kill him. And then Zipporah, his wife, took a sharp stone, cut off the foreskin of her son, and touched Moses' feet with it. Because of the rite of circumcision, she said to Moses, you are a husband of blood to me. And so the Lord spared Moses' life. Meanwhile, the Lord had said to Aaron, go to the desert to meet Moses. And so he went to meet him at the holy mountain, and when he met him, he kissed him. Then Moses told Aaron everything the Lord had said, and he told him to return to Egypt. He also told him about the miracles which the Lord had ordered him to perform. So Moses and Aaron went to Egypt and gathered all the Israelite leaders together. Aaron told them everything that the Lord had said to Moses, and then Moses performed all the miracles in front of the people. They believed, and when they heard that the Lord had come to them, and how that they were treated cruelly and bowed down and worshipped.
This is concluded with a celebration, chapter 15, verses 19 to 21. When the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his chariot drivers went into the sea, the Lord brought back the waters of the sea upon them. But the Israelites walked through the sea on dry ground. Then the prophet Miriam, Aaron's sister, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women went out after her with tambourines and with dancing. And Miriam sang to them, sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. Big celebration after the long Exodus experience. This is a key experience in the Israel history, and maybe we could discuss what strikes you about the call of Moses and Aaron and Miriam as God led them to act in history. What kinds of things stand out to you in this passage?
It was clear.
It was clear?
Go, Moses. That was clear. There was no, are you sure about this guy? I mean, you just said, no, I won't go.
It
was clear that God was calling.
Well, I find it a question of reality. It would be very easy to understand, very easy to follow if you knew God was talking to you. But that's the question I always have in these things. How do you really know that? For me now here, there is no burning bush. I walk out of my mind, how does God talk to me? And if I knew it was God talking to me, claiming the bush was burning and all that kind of stuff, it would be very simple to follow. For me in my life, if God said, well, do it, I'm not sure God was talking to me. That's where I am.
I share that.
None of these people were going out looking for a call from God. They were there, and God came to them. And they said, oh, wait a minute, I'm not ready for this. Have somebody else do it.
Mm-hmm. You wonder how it actually took place. It's clear the way it's presented here that God is really calling. Moses, having fled Egypt, working in a different country, and you know, what was it like in the desert, you know, where he was, or the rural area where he was taking care of the sheep and the flocks? Had a lot of time to meditate, reflect. Reflect back on what his people were experiencing, what he's doing here.
It's a big contrast of what he had escaped from Egypt and then now being out in the desert and just being a shepherd. Maybe he felt like he wasn't equal to going back to all that.
He protested he couldn't speak. You know,
yeah.
Why should I go back? I don't know how to speak.
And he was an educated man.
Mm-hmm. God had an answer.
Yes. It's interesting that his brother would be the good speaker, and his brother did not have a training yet.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed, though, that Moses was open to the call. I was just noticing this time in chapter 3, verses 3 and 4, it says, you know, the bush was burning, and verse 3 says, and Moses said, I will turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, then God called him out of the bush. It's like the Lord put this in front of him. Moses, in his spirit and in his dialogues and his meditations, was willing to be open, I think, to the experience. And as God saw that initial willingness, he then, in return, spoke to him, and then he knew from there.
Yeah, Moses obviously had an openness to it. Yeah, and how did he? You know, he was part of a tradition. You know, raised in Egypt, but came with whatever teachings and understandings of God and the people that somehow laid the base for his openness. Doesn't say a lot about that in here, but it had to have some preparation.
Isn't it strange that he
was more open to and more in touch with his Jewishness when it was only his mother he taught him than he was the Egyptian side when he had been taught practically from birth that whole society and their value system.
That is striking. You wonder how he got all that.
It also makes me think about brain development and little tiny children and how we treat them and all that. It's a problem that a wide train for me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for me, it would be like if I meditated somewhere in the hills and God said, I want you to go to Booth Gardner, and I want you to tell him, that's the governor, and I want you to let all the Christians, that's the same equivalency to me. That must have been a monumental thing for Moses. And I would say, not me, at first.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just an incredible thing he said.
It is. How long were they slaves in Egypt before Moses came along? How many generations? And
he also gave him some tools that he could use, though. I mean, the stick and the helmet, the hand.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, kind of real visible, tangible proof that I'm with him. And we need to give him gifts, but like the burning bush, you don't see him really far off. And if somebody gave me a stick to throw it down, turn into a snake,
yeah.
Pick it back up, and after there's something going on here, I'm backing up. So even if I had to go talk to Booth Gardner, it might not be.
What kind of stick is God giving you to talk to Booth? Yeah.
But
right.
Maybe it would be harder to talk to his own people than to talk to Booth. Maybe it would be harder to convince the Christians to go with
yeah.
To me, it seems that would be a harder task than going and talking to one person.
You form a committee, though.
One part I don't get, I really don't.
Well, there's a couple of parts.
When, God has called Moses, and then in 24, he says, the lodging place. The Lord met him and sought to kill him. That doesn't make sense.
No. Which?
424.
No, it doesn't, and I don't have an answer for that. It's just kind of a blurb experience, It's intrusion into the whole process. And, yeah, anybody have an answer? That.
It's, you wouldn't have to try very hard to get him because he had all the power.
What's that?
God would not have had to try very hard to kill him because he had all the power.
Power, yeah. But why would he try to kill him?
Isn't that the same kind of experience that Jacob had when he fought with the Lord?
Except this one, Moses apparently, as far as we can see, Moses wasn't even aware of what was going on. There's no indication that Moses...
Moses is saved by his wife.
Yeah. I mean, nothing that he did had anything to do with it. And as far as we know, he didn't even know what was happening. He was up in a corner snoring or something.
Mm-hmm. And he's on the way to do what the Lord asked him to do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's part of how you would get the Christians to follow you, is if your wife had such an experience.
One thing it says to me is that there are a lot of experiences that just don't fit, a process, that's not the answer to this, but, life as it goes about our calling, it's in fits and starts, and some things just don't fit. At least we don't see how they fit.
I have read one explanation for that passage, and it's just strange in terms of what this story appears to be saying to us. But the person that I was reading basically implied that Moses had not been circumcised. And it is true that in Hebrew, whenever you see the word feet, and it doesn't quite seem obvious that they're being walked on, that it's a euphemism for the genital region. And it's entirely possible that what Zipporah did was a symbolic circumcision of Moses himself in that passage, to make him fit to be one of the people who went. And it's also possible we're missing some of the details of the story, and that's why it doesn't make any sense.
That has some credibility, I think.
It strikes me that what he's also called to do is against the law. How would he convince all of these law-abiding people to follow him in this initial act of civil disobedience?
What law?
Well, it's the law of the land in which he dwells, you know, certainly not a God-given law. That would make it more radical still that he's...
tradition that the people would be brought back to the promised land at some point, that he was acting in the center of that tradition. So he's moving to a different law, the law of his people.
But the law of circumcision was somehow part of that at this time?
Part of the covenant.
And part of the covenant. Which the covenant was established in a very dramatic way in the desert, later experience. The Ten Commandments, and all that binding the people. But that was a later evolution.
I'm very interested in the concept of, or the understanding of God here. The one that I grew up with was this all-knowing and all-powerful God, and it's not so clear to me that this one is all-knowing and all-powerful. He's kind of bargaining with Moses. So he didn't know what Moses was going to say, and so he came up with his second best plan to let Aaron do it, and then tried to kill Moses, but couldn't. He's much more of a fumbling lesser, in some sense, not necessarily lesser, but he's not the all-powerful, all-knowing God that I grew up understanding.
So it's an evolution in Moses' own experience of God, and this was a point at which God was struggling too.
But that seems to me to be a consistent picture of God as I am becoming to realize God is at all. God always comes to us where we are and how we are, and without imposing his will upon us, but helping us to meet us where we are. God always met the people where they were, tried to make it possible for them. And that pattern to me seems to be a pattern that I am becoming understanding to the scriptures, because I also grew up with a powerful, all-knowing, all-authoritarian sort of God. And as I'm hearing this again, it seems to me that that's the process that I hear going on between God and man.
But we're also looking at it through Moses' eyes, even though inspired by God and all. It seems to me we're looking at the story through Moses' eyes, as each of us looks through God to our own eyes and our own experiences as it relates to God that way. I think if the story were told strictly through God's eyes, period, I think you'd find a different God that wants to treat you.
Not just Moses' eyes, I think, but the people who passed on the tradition orally for how many centuries, and then whoever wrote this down. So there's a lot of other eyes that are brought into this.
I run into the same thing with Abraham when he's negotiating with God on
several occasions.
Several occasions, I think particularly of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah as well, you know. Sure, you can do this. Do we have to go ahead with this? I got sure few good people there. Do we have to do this?
Yeah.
What is this matter of God's name? That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be kind of typical of the earliest chapters of Pentateuch.
Beginning with chapter 3. I think that, because I also, growing up in the Missouri Synod as I did, God was all-knowing, all these omnis. And in a sense, I have never given up those omnis. God is that. But it's when God, in my understanding, gave me my own will, God chose to limit the exercise of his power. And by limiting himself in that fashion, he can no longer pull the strings on me or on Moses. And, okay, yep, God, whatever you say, you know, he has to deal with God, with Moses, very much where Moses is, and very much where we are. It's very vivid in this story, in the bargaining with Jacob, for example, or in the classic story of Jonah.
Well, then in the flow of history, given that, I've wondered that if Moses had said, no, not me, and that's it, would we have had some other name stuck in there for what God's plan was for the Israelites?
I mean, one kind of has to assume so, because God's will is always accomplished in some fashion. Of course, the game of what if is always the most fascinating game in the world. What if Abraham had said, forget it, God?
Right.
You know, I'm not leaving Haran. Are you kidding? I'm a long, you know, somebody else would have been chosen.
How many other people
said no?
We don't know.
We don't hear about those.
Right.
Moses may have been the 25th person God asked.
Yeah.
But if you extend that up to now, is God asking you to do something specific and unique in this world? And is he going to keep after you until you do it? Or can you turn him down and he's going to get the next person?
Yeah, good question. I suspect God will hound me either until I say yes or until I die.
Or until you say no, I mean it.
Yeah, well,
I think there's every reason to think that there are opportunities missed. I mean, there's every reason to think that. I think that, you know, I'm not quite sure how, you know, perhaps the bowl of the universe bends towards justice, but we can miss epochs of opportunity, I think, and those are dependent on individual decision and action. And I don't think there's any indication, any reliable indication to me that God overrules that, and if it's going to come out okay, whatever, our failure is not.
But I may keep coming back to the blasted salt on the road. It seems like, oh, you're my man, and we're getting it now, and we have no choices.
No, I think Saul always had that choice. He could have said, you know, Satan, why did you do this to me? He could have said, under no circumstances.
We all have the choice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if not, then why would Christ cry with Jerusalem? Right. Or any of those situations? Why would Christ grieve or over our action if we were forced to say yes?
It's the mystery of it, isn't it? Mm-hmm. How much?
The outcome was already known, which is a little different. But
mm-hmm.
And once we've said yes, then as we go along, how many times do we then still have a choice? Because, you know, he gives him Aaron to speak in his behalf. He gives him these wonderful tools. You know, throw down the rod. If you read a few chapters later, and threw down the rod and became a snake. Pharaoh's magicians did the very same thing. Even though that snake devoured magician's snake, turn the water into blood. Pharaoh's magicians did the same. You know, it was quite a task. It wasn't a simple once for all kind of situation.
You failed a couple
over
of times.
Over again. You know, if I was Moses and this had happened, I mean, my goodness, what kind of tools have you given me? Finally, we get to the gnats, and somehow the magician's kind of moving, and I say, whew. It looks like maybe this is going to be okay.
What about the activity of the Holy Spirit? Was it inactive at that time?
I can't believe it was inactive, but you know, the concept of God being three in one. It,
but we can't believe except through the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And our activity is, well, influenced by that.
I believe the Spirit was acting throughout history. You know,
I agree.
And their experience of God was just evolving, and it just got to the point where I am who am, a new expression. So just have one God present as opposed to many gods. It was a big step forward for the people at that time.
One of the things I've wrestled with is, you know, I believe we're called to be peacemakers, yet like in the Old Testament, there seems to be a lot of instances where, like Abraham and Isaac, of you know, violent type situations. Non-Christians sometimes will point to this, about, you know, if God is a God of love, then, you know, why all these violent things in the Old Testament? It seems to be just a different, I don't know, I wrestle with that, the influence of violence and war,
in the Old Testament, and are called this is looking at upon it as a evolutionary process, and you know, looking at the history in the Old Testament versus the New Testament, you know, God giving as an example the people a king was more of a concession on God's part. When David and Solomon and so forth were kings, God didn't want a kingdom according to certain passages in here. And people wanted a king because all their neighbors had kings, so he conceded that. But that goes on to the New Testament where Christ came to bring the kingdom. And his disciples and apostles kept looking for a worldly kingdom, and Christ said, my kingdom is not of this world. So, different appreciations of what it means to follow God, to follow God's ways. And it seems that we grow in our understanding. We're still struggling with it. What does it mean today to be Christian? People who are pacifist to people who are very pro-war, all within the Christian tradition.
You know, God may also be growing. The sermon I heard in Washington talked about Noah, the Noah story, and how God figured that he'd made a mistake that time by wiping out everything, and that was what the bowl represented, was that he wasn't going to do that anymore. You know, that he muffed it. He got angry at Aaron here. You know, that's a funny expression. We don't think of it as a loving thing, exactly. I don't know. Maybe that's not true. Maybe it's all right to get angry, but it, you know, there was God getting angry. It seems kind of petty for God. You know, I mean, you know, he might, or she, you know, God might be growing and might look back at telling Moses to go in and see to the death of all the Egyptian firstborn as another kind of blunderous thing, but hadn't figured out how to a better way.
You know, we speculated about whether or not Moses was the 25th person that God asked finally found somebody who was going to do something. And we talk about each of us has the free will to accept or not, follow or not. But when it comes down to a specific story in the Bible where God asked someone to do something, and they did it. It could be that God only asked someone whom God thought would obey and didn't ask 24 or 25 other people. Notwithstanding Moses' objections or anybody else's objections, that was the one that God knew would obey and would follow him and would say yes.
I think God's asking us to do things all the time, and our sinfulness is our same.
How does God talk to you? How does God talk to you?
It's not like you hear a voice or see a burning bush.
It seems like God rules with what he has. It seems like God works with what he has. When you look at different congregations, or just an individual congregation too, sure things do get done. Even though maybe you lose a lot of people, but somehow other people do.
Somehow. Some things get undone, but you think of when the rich young man came to Christ and said, "What do I have to do to follow you?" And Christ said, "Keep my commandments." "Well, I've kept those." "Well, if you really want to follow me, give up all these things and come." And the young man went away. So I believe what you're saying. We're always getting calls, indications of ways to follow God. And sometimes we lock into it and go, and sometimes we, back away. But
I really think that, I don't know whether Moses was the first and only, or whether he was the 5th or 6th or the 25th. And over the years, I've acquired this list of questions I want to ask God someday. along with the question about, I don't know if you've read Judges. If you have, and don't. It's full of blood and violence and gore.
Yeah, the walls of Jericho.
Well, the whole process of going into Egypt is one of God instructing them to eliminate in its entirety the people going into Canaan. Eliminate in its entirety the inhabitants of that land. And the Israelites did not. And they paid the consequences for centuries because they had all these neighbors around who were not a part of the covenant and who practiced that, who seduced them over and over and over and over. But still, why didn't you just move them out, God? Get them to migrate someplace else. Then you could have saved the bloodshed. I'd still like to know. And it still goes on and on and on.
So my God is all-knowing. So he's seen the movie. So he would know how I have the free will. But he knows because he's seen the movie of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Because in my mind, he is all.
But you don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know.
He's seen the movie of Moses' life too.
Yeah.
But God has seen the movie of your life. Then your free will is reduced.
Pardon?
If God has seen the movie of your life, then you have no free will. You only think you do. Everything is completely determined.
Your movie
nothing
isn't
done.
No.
To you.
Pardon?
Your movie isn't completed yet.
No.
If God has seen it, it is completed.
But does that mean that God's determined it? God hasn't determined her choices or my choices.
No, he doesn't determine my choices in my mind.
That would mean God would be limited by time.
What?
God would be limited by time. Because he can see ahead. If he could, if it were true that he had seen the movie, but we still have free will, that could be possible because God is outside time.
I
don't know if I believe it, but I think it's possible.
I think God has a sense of humor, too. And I think sometimes he may play games, or he or she may play games in the sense of, let's see what this person will do. Let me push this person, And so I'm not certain that it's a straight movie, that it's all laid out already. there may be various avenues in God to say, okay, let's see what we can do, you know, and I don't know, it's hard to put it all in a box, but I just don't see it as black and white as that, that God sees, I acknowledge that God's all-knowing, but at the same time, like you say, with time, there's things that are meaningful.
Maybe the key is he's all-knowing and we aren't, and then we try to decide what it means to be all-knowing.
Right. So it's like beyond definition or something.
Well, it seems to me, though, pretty clear that in this passage that there isn't any indication that he's all-knowing. I mean, he says, you know, I think maybe if you try these two tricks that you'll get it, but if not, we still got some more. I mean, that's not, you know, I mean, so you've held that view, and maybe you're right, but it certainly doesn't come out of these two chapters.
But he does tell that the Pharaoh isn't going to believe it.
The thing is, he's testing Moses, too.
I think part, for me at least, part of the whole, this whole scenario, and while I find very frustrating to me, as a layperson, as a mathematician, I make no pretense that I can understand, say, Einstein. I mean, I've read it, vaguely makes sense, but I don't understand it at any gut level. And yet I'd likely go along assuming that I understand the mind of the creator of the entire universe. You know, logically, wait a minute here. Right. I've got it backwards. How can I understand something that is so much greater than I, and yet I cannot even understand another human being? You know, it's an incredible ego trip on my part.
Yeah. The image of God theme of Holden this summer is beautiful and yet so inadequate. There's no image that we can put in our mind that captures God. We get little bits and bites, you know. And for me, the things I'm learning about the evolution of the world, life itself, going 15 billion years back, you know, through time, through telescopes and other means, that's fantasy. But there, people are, you know, getting it, and, you know, just, so how can we capture God in an image? I find myself changing from my childhood idea of God being a man up there, you know, laying out everything, to more mystical type of impression of God, that God somehow is acting within me and within life, and the farther I can get away from ideas, the closer I might be to experiencing God, even though my richest experiences of God are in nature, you know, and in people. That's where I get highs from. I don't get highs from trying to be mystical about God, but
God does some great things, though. Indirectly says, in the fullness of time, when the time was right, that's when these things succeeded. Now, when Moses took it upon himself to try to help the Israelites.
Right. It was the time. And if we had not gotten so tied up with Moses and his experience, we would have read Mary's time, which was Mary acting in history in her fullness of time.
Right.
You know.
It seems to me the most significant thing in all of this is that 13, 14 verses in chapter 3 where it talks about God giving Moses God's name, I am who I am, which is the authority to then go and do. Mm-hmm. So that all this wondering about whether God is certain or not certain is really ends for me at that very moment when God gives up what is the most precious of all things, that is this name which we then become the anagram Yahweh, and said, you have the authority to go. And that then has to do with how we understand this call actually in our lives, because it changed Moses at that point to be given that kind of authority.
Exactly.
I am who I am,
mm-hmm.
has called you. Oh, now, and burning bushes and everything else may come to us, but there has to be that moment when we receive what God gives us, and I think the preciousness, the intimacy of God's gift to us comes in this 13 and 14, and that gives us the authority to receive the call.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about that I am who I am, that God is really a verb, a God of being, and this passage really is not about Moses, it's about God. God calls, God equips, God sends, and God ultimately liberates.
And that's where the authority is.
And God promises to be with.
Is his only gift to us authority?
No, not necessarily.
No.
So it sounds to me like
there's authority with the call.
Authenticity, I guess, is another word that fits that too.
When God says, promises to be with, that's the authority.
Yeah. Is that a gift of authority or a gift of love?
Can I conclude this with going back to Good Shepherd Church and a song, The Call to Be God's People, because that's what this should all lead to, is our own individual struggle with being actors in history like Moses and like Mary. So let me read this hymn. The call to be God's people is new in every age, yet written clearly, boldly, on all our history page. How dare we claim that calling with seers and common folk, who stood for faith in action and listened when God spoke. We dare because Christ claims us and gives us work and skill to make our witness daily, responding to God's will. The task is placed before us in dreams to be made real. We find our common calling to teach, support, and heal. So let us join together as God's new people here in partnership and mission because the call is clear. I wish. The world awaits the dawning of that long promised day when love shall be standard that none can take away. Thank you for your sharing, participation.